Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, June 5th, 2023. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. The Pentagon has released a video recording of a near-miss collision between a U.S. destroyer and a Chinese naval vessel in the Taiwan Strait over the weekend. It's the second close encounter in the past week between the American and Chinese militaries. We'll hear what the White House has to say about it coming up. Four people are dead after a plane with an unresponsive pilot flew through restricted airspace over Washington, D.C., then crashed in Virginia on Sunday. The plane was followed by F-16 fighter jets authorized by NORAD to fly at supersonic speed, and that set off a sonic boom that was heard and felt across the D.C. area from Annapolis, Maryland to Fredericksburg, Virginia. We'll hear what the White House had to say about that coming up as well. And more ins and outs in the 2024 Republican presidential race. Former Vice President Mike Pence, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and North Dakota Governor Todd Burgum are all expected to jump into the race this week, while New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu says he's staying out. Meanwhile, one declared candidate, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, got into it today with the hosts of the ABC daytime program, The View. We begin at the White House, where National Security Council spokesman John Kirby talked about the weekend's near miss between a U.S. and Chinese naval vessel.
In the span of a week, we've now had two close encounters, one at sea, one in the air with the Chinese military. Are these isolated incidents, or is China becoming more aggressive?
Sadly, Ed, these are part and parcel of an increasing level of aggressiveness by the PLA, the PRC's military, in particularly in the area of the Taiwan Straits and in the South China Sea. One, the air intercept was over the South China Sea, and the maritime intercept that you talk about was in the Straits. And sadly, this is just part, again, of a growing aggressiveness by the PRC that we're dealing with, and we're prepared to address it. You heard Secretary Austin speak to that out at the Shangri-La Dialogue just this past weekend, and we're going to continue to keep the lines open with the Chinese to make it clear how unacceptable those particular intercepts are.
There was that handshake at the Shangri-La Conference. Has there been any other conversation between U.S. and Chinese officials?
Well, I think you know we have two officials in Beijing right now, the Senior Director for China, Sarah Barron here, and Dan Crittenbrink from the State Department are in Beijing as we speak.
I know you have to be very careful about the words you choose, but what is, in describing this, but what is the best way to describe what China is doing in the air and on the seas?
I'll try to give you an answer, but I sure would like to hear Beijing justify what they're doing. That said, these are intercepts. Now look, air and maritime intercepts happen all the time. Heck, we do it. The difference is when we do it, when we feel like we need to do it, it's done professionally, and it's done inside the international law, and it's done in accordance with the rules of the road. These two that you saw recently, and they have happened with more frequency than we'd like. Not all of them are unsafe and unprofessional, but these two were. You saw in the air intercept that they forced our aircraft, an RC-135, to basically go through the jet wash. That you saw the bump in the cockpit. That shows you how close that Chinese fighter was to our jet. And in the maritime intercept in the Taiwan Straits, 150, 140, 150 yards. Speaking as an old sailor myself, I'll tell you that's pretty close when you're in open waters like that. And you can see the head of steam that Chinese vessel had on it as it crossed the bow of one of our destroyers. No call for that. It's unsafe. It's unprofessional. And as to why they're doing it, I think again, I think that's a great question to ask them. What I would tell you from our perspective is, we're flying, we're sailing, we're operating in international airspace and international waters, and both of those incidents were in complete compliance with international law. There was absolutely no need for the PLA to act as aggressively as they did. It won't be long before somebody gets hurt.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby at today's White House briefing. That close encounter between the two U.S. and Chinese ships took place on the same day where Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and his Chinese counterpart were both attending an annual security conference in Singapore. And more now on that incident involving a plane with an unresponsive pilot that violated D.C. airspace yesterday. Here's more on that from John Kirby.
John, if I could ask you about the NORAD intercept yesterday.
Yes, sir.
If you could help us understand, there was a period of time yesterday where it wasn't clear what was going on. We think we have a sense of what happened, a tragic incident. But can you walk us through, maybe give us a tick-tock of NSC involvement in this? And was there a point at which yesterday the Commander-in-Chief was informed that there was a wayward plane headed for Washington and might have
hit? Well, the President was certainly briefed and informed. I don't have, like, the... I should have brought it with me. I don't have, like, an exact tick-tock minute by minute, but I can walk you through a little bit of how it transpired in the process. So before I do that, though, I do want to express our deepest condolences to the family members, the loved ones of those who died in that crash. Just terrible. Terrible news. Nobody wants to get that, and we need to keep them front and center as we talk about this. But this is part of, you might remember after 9/11, Operation Noble Eagle was stood up. And it's an organized operational way of policing airspace, particularly sensitive airspace over the United States in the wake of 9/11. There are Noble Eagle-like incidents that happen from time to time where private aircraft wander into secure airspace and we have to notify them to leave. And 99 times out of 100, that's all it takes is a quick call on the radio, hey, you're getting into some airspace you don't need to be in, and usually that takes care of it. But under this process, if an aircraft, if a pilot is non-responsive to those requests and continues on course and speed and altitude to enter restricted airspace, then there are, under NORAD's authorities, there are the responsibilities to put aircraft up to again send the message and get a different outcome. And that's what happened here. Six F-16s from three different air bases on the East Coast. Certainly, Joint Base Andrews was one of those three launched into the air. Six F-16s, three air bases launched to intercept this particular Cessna Citation. As I understand it, the two from Andrews were the first ones to reach the Cessna, and they had to turn on the speed to get to them, which is why people here in the district area heard a sonic boom. They had to break the sound barrier to get up the speed to get to the aircraft in question. When they did, they did exactly what they were supposed to do: try to get on the radio, communicate to the pilot. That wasn't working. Made themselves visible. That didn't work. And tragically, it ended obviously in the crash and the death of all on board. But throughout that process, there's a conference call that's set up when you have a Noble Eagle incident, where NORAD's on the phone, DOD's on the phone, NSC was on the phone, in real time, monitoring it and getting real time updates from the pilots. In this case, these two F-16 pilots, and so that everybody's in the loop, literally in real time, and that's what happened yesterday. And again, at the appropriate time, the President was briefed and kept informed.
Was he informed while he was at JBA, or was it after?
I honestly don't know the exact moment at which the President was informed, but he was briefed on the incident.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. FAA officials told NBC Washington that the Cessna crashed into a mountain near the George Washington National Forest in Virginia after it ran out of fuel and left behind, quote, highly fragmented wreckage that will take days to gather and sort. Moving to Capitol Hill, the House is back at work today. Lawmakers are working on several financial services-related bills. Later in the week, they'll work on several bills to block the Biden administration's proposal on gas stove regulation. The House is also expected to vote on legislation to increase congressional oversight of the federal rulemaking process by agencies. The Senate is back tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Senators will continue work on more of President Biden's executive and judicial nominations, including ACLU voting director Dale Ho to be a U.S. District Court judge for Southern New York. And the lead Republican negotiator, one of them, is shedding more light on the debt ceiling talks from last week. Here's House Financial Services Chair Patrick McHenry on the Hugh Hewitt Show talking about his approach to negotiating with the White House.
Part of this is making sure they understand the terms by which we're negotiating. And the terms by which we're negotiating were the bill we passed out of the House. And there are a lot of things we wanted to include in the negotiations that weren't a part of that bill. But we thought it was better, and we'd have a better structural conversation if we started with the legislation that we passed out of the House to raise the debt ceiling and take on the fiscal house. and include growth opportunities with policy changes. So that was the basis. And frankly, had you gone through a time-lapse photography of this or the notes from that meeting, the first 7 days, well, first 10 days, 7 days, we'd not progress at all. They were stubbornly unwilling to come to terms with spending less year over year, and they didn't want work requirements. They didn't want permitting reform. They didn't want to touch any of the environmental laws that we forced them to touch. So it took a long time for us to make a small amount of progress before we had some breakthroughs.
House Financial Services Committee Chair Patrick McHenry on the Hugh Hewitt Show. And on CNBC's Squawk Box today, here's House Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
We ended up getting 67% of Republicans voting for this bill. But if you take the average of what normally Republicans vote for, especially when you have a Democrat president, it's about 24%. So you improved that, you tripled your vote with that places. Now, if you look at how do Republicans vote for a debt ceiling when they have a Republican president and a Republican House, it's less than that at 65%. So we surpassed all expectations. So if you want to measure the bill based upon that, we achieved more than we've been able to do in the past. And I think that's reflective about what's in the bill. And if you want to talk about different members, you can look at who. Now, what Democrats voted against the bill? Democrats normally vote for debt ceilings, regardless what's in the bill. But Bernie Sanders and AOC did not. So they didn't just vote against the bill. They argued against the bill. They said it was detrimental. They said work requirements were a red line, but they ended up voting for it. They said they would never do anything on IRS agents, and they gave up more than $21 billion. That was already in law, and they reversed course. This is a president who had to sign that. They said they didn't want to give up the COVID money. They did. They are now always in the past going dollar for dollar with defense and non-defense, and now non-defense is below 22 levels, and they voted for that and now signed it into law. So now the Democrats are on record doing things they never said they would do, especially at the beginning of this negotiation.
And the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget saying that the debt ceiling law, quote, represents the largest deficit reduction package in almost 12 years, generating $250 billion to $2.1 trillion of savings while helping to fight inflation, promote stronger economic growth, and ensure the country continues to pay its bills. Here's more from Speaker McCarthy on CNBC.
I think this was a turning of the ship, a movement in the right direction. I mean, think about what we were able to achieve. For one of the first times, we were going to spend less than we spent last year. The Center for Fiscal Responsibility, this is the biggest cut in American history, $2.1 trillion. We were able to pull back the COVID funding that we had, the largest rescissions in American history. You can add up all the rescissions. This is larger than all of them accumulated together. What you found going forward, NEPA reform. Cutting the red tape where we're limiting the how length you can study something so you can build it. I think you're going to see a growth in the economy based upon that. Restructuring Congress in the point that I get so frustrated that we don't do the most basic things we're supposed to do, like our 12 appropriation bills. So we change the structure in that. If we don't get our job done, there's a 1% cut across the board. Everybody has an angst about that. Well, what that really means is it's going to force us to do our job. I think these are very healthy movements in the right direction. It doesn't solve the problem by any means, but it does put us in a new path of moving forward.
And with the debt ceiling deal done, here's White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre on the prospect of bipartisanship going forward.
Like I said, we've seen under this president, there's been about 350 pieces of bipartisan legislation that this president has signed into law. Many of those were historic pieces of legislation. When you think about the bipartisan infrastructure legislation, Inflation Reduction Act, all these pieces of legislation that's going to create good paying jobs, lower costs for healthcare costs for Americans, lower energy costs for Americans, CHIPS and Science Act, when you think about manufacturing jobs, creating manufacturing jobs in this country. So look, these are all important things, important issues that the president wants to continue to work on, to continue to implement. And I talked about the gun reform. We believe that there is a common sense approach here that we can move forward and work with Congress on. Reproductive rights, we believe that this is something that we need to continue to work very hard towards, making sure that the wealthy pay their fair share as well, and not just leave it on the little guy. And so, look, we're going to continue to work on an economy that works for everyone, making sure that it we build it from the bottom up, middle out. Those are the things that the president feels that he needs to continue to work towards. And so, yeah, there are places that we see that could be a bipartisanship here. If we're really serious about the deficit, really serious about making sure that we reduce the deficit, the president put forth a budget plan March 9th on how we can reduce the deficit by $3 trillion in the next 10 years. And so, yeah, there are ways that we believe that can be that we can move forward here with Congress.
Any plans for the president and the speaker to meet again in a non-crisis, non-emergency setting?
No plans yet.
And while we are a few months away from Congress's next funding deadline, that would be the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, CQ Roll Call Editor-in-Chief Jason Dick talked about what he thinks about the prospect of another fiscal fight leading up to the end of the fiscal year and whether that could lead to a government shutdown.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, Washington tends to, we tend to get in gear, you know, again, towards the very end. I wouldn't expect that we're going to start worrying about government shutdowns until September, and then things kind of come together quickly on either a continuing resolution or a short-term funding bill. Now, part of this debt limit deal, if they don't sign the appropriations bills into law, there's a 1% cut that would kick in for all programs, which is a real motivator for
everything.
For everything, for defense and non-defense spending. So that tends to focus the mind a little bit. I mean, it does seem, I was talking about this with my wife when we were talking about the summer. It seems like the summer's already gone. It hasn't started yet, but it seems like it's already gone when you start planning, like, oh, you know, kids are going back to school, and this is where we're going to visit our friends, and this is where it's kind of like that with Congress. They know that this month, I would suspect if we haven't, you know, in the time that we've been talking, that the House and the Senate are going to start scheduling their markups at the committee level of appropriations bills. They put all those on hold because of the debt limit drama and how it was. I mean, they didn't want to mark something up that would be overtaken by, you know, the policies that were set in the debt limit deal. So we've got, you know, a few weeks to go before the Independence Day recess. And we're going to see, I think, a flurry of activity at the committee level. The appropriations people are going to, especially the appropriations committee leaders, are going to be very motivated to try to get their stamp on the appropriations process. So that's, I'm not, you know, you never rule out, you know, Congress doing, you know, making things difficult on themselves. But there are several motivating factors that weren't there in previous years. And it's tempting to say September 30th is right around the corner, but they do have a little bit of a, you know, they've got the summer until August. And sometimes
they've got plenty of time.
Yes. And that also may, you know, they tend to stay a few to extra days sometimes, especially if they've got something.
Well, speaking of history, I want to go back to 1996 and explain what happened in that year, because that was the last time Congress actually completed all 12 appropriation bills.
Right.
What happened that year, and why? What was special?
So, divided government, for one. You know, we had you know, President Clinton. He was in his own reelection bid. The Republicans controlled both chambers, both the House and the Senate. And despite, you know, the way that I think a lot of people view the '90s, there was this time of like extreme partisanship. And I'm not saying that there wasn't extreme partisanship. After the initial sort of government shutdowns of the, you know, the early, you know, parts of that first Congress that took office in 1995 after the 1994 elections, the Speaker Newt Gingrich and President Clinton figured out a way to work together. They figured out a way to do things like welfare reform. They figured out a way to get the trains, you know, sort of running back on time, and, you know, this actually produced a status quo election in 1996. The president was reelected over Bob Dole, and, you know, the Republicans maintained their majorities in both chambers.
CQ Roll Call Editor-in-Chief Jason Dick on today's Washington Journal. You can see that whole segment at cspan.org/Washington Journal and the C-SPAN Now mobile app. And coming up this week on Capitol Hill, we have two hearings scheduled for tomorrow looking at the southern border. First, a House Oversight Subcommittee on migrant surges and how they've impacted law enforcement staffing along the border. Then a House Homeland Security Subcommittee examines the Biden administration's level of preparedness for the surge of migrants when Title 42 expired. Now, on Wednesday, the House Intelligence Committee will hear testimony from former committee members, including California Democrat Jane Harman and Florida Republican Ileana Ross-Leighton. They'll talk about national security and intelligence-related matters. Those hearings will be live on the C-SPAN networks. You can find schedule information on our C-SPAN Now app at cspan.org and follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. House Oversight Committee Chair James Comer announced today that he will start proceedings to hold FBI Director Christopher Wray in contempt of Congress. The decision came after the FBI briefed Representative Comer and Oversight Committee Ranking Member Jamie Raskin on Capitol Hill for more than an hour today on a document that purportedly describes an allegation that Joe Biden accepted a bribe as vice president. You can see the full statements from Representatives Comer and Raskin on the meeting at cspan.org. California Democrat and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is scheduled to throw out the ceremonial first pitch at Nationals Park tomorrow night. She's appearing at Major League Baseball's longest-running LGBTQ-themed event called Nationals Night Out. The 83-year-old lawmaker is being recognized by the team for, quote, her longstanding commitment to fighting for the rights and dignities of the LGBTQ+ community. The Nationals said a portion of the ticket sales from tomorrow's game against the NL West leading Arizona Diamondbacks will be donated to Team DC, an organization that supports the LGBTQ community on the benefits of individual and team sports participation. Three men are in, and one says he's staying out of the 2024 Republican presidential race. The three in: current North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, who put out a campaign announcement video today; former New Jersey Republican Governor Chris Christie, who's expected to announce his campaign on Wednesday; also on Wednesday, former Vice President Mike Pence, who teased his announcement about this last week.
And I couldn't be more proud to have been part of the administration that appointed three of the justices that sent Roe versus Wade to the ash heap of history where it belongs. We gave America a new beginning for life, and we can do it all again. And I'm here in Iowa today, and I'll be back a little bit later next week. Because Iowa's the place that we shaped principled conservative leadership. Iowa's the place that shaped the standard bearer of this party. And I have to tell you, over the last 2 years, Karen and I have spent a lot of time reflecting and praying about everything this country's dealing with and what we might do to serve. And I don't have anything to announce today, but I can tell you, when I got time to announce, come this Wednesday, I'm announcing in Iowa.
That happened on Saturday, and as for the one who says he's staying out of the race, here's New Hampshire Republican Governor Chris Sununu.
We've taken the last 6 months to really kind of look at things, where everything is, and I've made the decision not to run for president on the Republican ticket in 2024. And obviously, a lot goes into that decision, but it's been quite an adventure, but not the end of the adventure by any means.
Why? Why won't you run?
Well, when you look at what's happening out there, you obviously have a very large field. I think the former president, Trump, is doing much better in the polls than folks thought. And when I looked at where my voice can be, how we make the Republican Party bigger, the responsibility that I think I have in terms of focusing on the Republican Party and ultimately focusing on the opportunities for the country, and having a little more of a candidate, a little more unleashed voice, and getting folks to not just worry about, well, is it a vote for Chris Sununu? I'm not worried about that. I want more independents on the Republican Party team. I want more young voters on the Republican Party team. I am tired of losing U.S. Senate races and governor's races. And clearly, I talk a bit candidly, I think, as folks appreciate, I think more folks within the Republican Party have to have that kind of voice, that kind of emphasis of message, and making sure that this is about the Republican Party, not just about the former president.
But part of your decision is about the former president, right? Is it?
Oh, sure.
It's about the size of the field. There are 12, by the end of the week, there will be 12 candidates for the Republican nomination. Yeah. and you're not going to be one of them, but you think that's too big?
Well, it's look, I don't mind who gets into the field, but given where the polls are right now, every candidate needs to understand the responsibility of getting out and getting out quickly if it's not working. And I can be more candid about that as the governor of the First in the Nation primary, calling candidates out, saying, look, you gave it a try. You're still in low single digits. You got to get out of the race.
By when? What's the deadline?
Christmas at the latest. If we do what we did in 2016, you're going to have somebody win this nomination with 35% of the Republican support. That's not where we should be as a party. That's not where anybody wants to be.
But it's not just somebody for you. It's Donald Trump.
Well, it is. But again, it's somebody who is in the past. He served the country. Thank you for your service. We have to be a party in a country that goes forward. And if we're only talking about Donald Trump, then we're only talking about relitigating elections or January 6th. We're only talking about yesterday. But this is the United States of America. As a candidate, you got to be what you're going to bring to the table.
New Hampshire Republican Governor Chris Sununu speaking on CNN earlier today. Meanwhile, South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott, who jumped into the race 2 weeks ago, appeared on the ABC daytime show The View today. And a heated discussion broke out when he started to talk about his views on race with co-host Sonny Hostin.
One of the things I think about, and one of the reasons why I'm on the show, is because of the comments that were made, frankly, on this show, that the only way for a young African-American kid to be successful in this country is to be the exception and not the rule. That is a dangerous, offensive, disgusting message to send to our young people today, that the only way to succeed is by being the exception. I will tell you that if my life is the exception, I can't imagine.
But
it's not, actually.
It's been 114 years.
Yeah, so the fact of the matter is we've had an African-American president, African-American vice president. We've had two African-Americans to be secretaries of the state. In my home city, the police chief is an African-American who's now running for mayor. The head of the highway patrol for South Carolina is an African-American. In 1975, there was about 15% unemployment in the African-American community for the first time in the history of the country. It's under 5%.
40%. Homelessness
and 50%
of African Americans.
50% of the folks in our community
get 13% of the population.
You had the chance to ask the question. I know that I've watched you on the show that you like people to be deferential and respectful. So I'm going to do the same thing.
That is true.
So here's what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest the fact of the matter is that progress in America is palpable. It could be measured in generations. I look back at the fact that my grandfather, born in 1921 in Sally, South Carolina, when he was on a sidewalk, a white person was coming, he had to step off and not make eye contact. That man believed then, with some doubt now, in the goodness of America, because he believed that having faith in God, faith in himself, and faith in what the future could hold for his kids would unleash opportunities in ways that you cannot imagine. Every kid today can look, just change the stations and see how much progress has been made in this country. ABC, NBC, CBS, ESPN, CNN, Fox News all have African-American and Hispanic hosts. So what I'm suggesting is that the yesterday's exception is today's rule. And for us to suggest...
So America has met its promise.
No, of course, the concept of America is that we are going to become a more perfect union. But in fact, the challenges that we faced 50 years ago and 60 years ago should not be the same challenges that we face today.
Republican presidential candidate Senator Tim Scott on the ABC daytime talk show The View. You can see more from our campaign 2024 coverage on our C-SPAN Now free mobile video app or anytime online at cspan.org. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee Policy Summit began today here in D.C. It's an annual event put on by the pro-Israel lobby group. And one of the featured speakers today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We have to start from this. The U.S.-Israel relationship is underwritten by the United States' commitment to Israel's security. That commitment is non-negotiable. It is ironclad. We are providing $3.3 billion in foreign military financing to Israel each year. On top of that, Israel receives $500 million in funding for missile defense, tens of millions more for new counter-drone and anti-tunneling technologies. That is in keeping with the 2016 Memorandum of Understanding negotiated by the Obama-Biden administration, and it is more than at any point in the history of our relationship. We're also delivering an additional $1 billion in funding to replenish supplies for Israel's Iron Dome, the missile defense system that we developed together and that has saved countless lives. All of this has been secured in partnership with our Congress with bipartisan support. We're also expanding our joint military exercises that improve how our forces work together seamlessly. This year, we have more joint exercises scheduled than at any point in our history. We're also conducting joint research and development on advanced military capabilities, working together on cutting-edge defense systems, including Israel's new laser-focused Iron Beam. This robust support continues to be critical in maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge, buttressing its ability to defend itself, and to advancing our national interests. America is more secure when Israel is strong.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken earlier today at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee Policy Summit. You can see his whole remarks at cspan.org. And finally, today marks the 20th anniversary of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. The program, which was spearheaded by President George W. Bush and Congress, passed on a bipartisan basis, reports saving more than 25 million lives since 2003. Today, the Bipartisan Policy Center held a panel discussion on the legislation's lasting impact. Here's former Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Frist, who helped support the measure when he was Senate Majority Leader.
20 years ago, as Senate Majority Leader, I worked closely with President Bush and members of both parties to enact PEPFAR. As I reflect on that time, I'm struck by the whole cadre of supporters from all sides of the aisle. These supporters include the faith-based community, the military, and public companies willing to form partnerships with government. I'm pleased that all those key supporters are represented in our discussion today. Putting a face on compassionate conservatism, the faith-based community offered hope at a time when hope seemed lacking. Given deeply established ties to the most vulnerable communities, faith-based organizations helped build trust and lead the charge. Sometimes the message of hope is tied not only to the message, but to the messenger. Faith-based organizations have consistently been an indispensable messenger for PEPFAR. 20 years ago, before the establishment of PEPFAR, a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS was considered a death sentence, resulting in millions and millions of deaths, along with millions of AIDS orphans. Losing a parent is difficult, especially as a child. It can lead to economic insecurity, to community health shocks, to the potential for societal destabilization. That's why it was critical for PEPFAR to step into the breach and provide vital support. Support that not only aids those families, but also helps to provide political stability. Last year, PEPFAR provided critical care and support to over 7 million orphans and vulnerable children and their caregivers. And as a result of the public health infrastructure that PEPFAR has established, tens of millions more individuals now have greatly expanded access to improved health care for a range, for really all other diseases. You think of infectious diseases, for chronic illnesses, for maternal and child health.
Former Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Frist speaking at the Bipartisan Policy Center at an event marking the 20th anniversary of PEPFAR. According to their website, PEPFAR is the largest commitment by any nation to address a single disease in the world. To date, its funding has totaled more than $110 billion, including contributions to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS and the Tuberculosis and Malaria Global Fund. You can learn more about the effort to pass PEPFAR on our podcast, The Weekly. Host Howard Mortman takes a deep dive into the PEPFAR legislation. You'll hear remarks from President George W. Bush and then Senator Joe Biden, and also a look back on how the bill came to be one of President Bush's greatest legacies. You can find The Weekly on our C-SPAN Now mobile app at cspan.org or wherever you get your podcasts. That's also where you can find this program as a podcast. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, subscribe to our evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.